Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judakin. With me today is Dr. Steven Schlossman, an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the associate director of training for child and adolescent psychiatry at Massachusetts General Hospital. A longtime fan of popular culture, and especially of horror films, Schlossman has written about movies, books, pop songs, and sports in blogs for the Boston Globe, Psychology Today, and in academic journals. He's also the author of The Zombie Autopsies, Secret Notebooks from the Apocalypse, and we're going to speak about his wild zombie novel and about zombie neuroscience today on Counterpoint. Steve, I'm really looking forward to this.
So am I. Thanks for having me.
Steve, how does a professor of psychiatry come to write novels about zombies?
That's a good question. Originally, it was just a lark. It was actually kind of a sublimated lark. This is a sad story, but it has a happy ending, so I don't mind telling it. My wife developed breast cancer in 2008, and I had little kids, and it was a scary time for everybody. And she's absolutely fine now. That's the happy ending. But I couldn't sleep, so I was staying up late and watching whatever happened to be on TV when I got tired of writing. And Night of the Living Dead was on, which was like comfort food to me, because I'd already mastered those monsters. I had mastered my wife's breast cancer, obviously, but the zombies I could handle. So I was watching that. It's an eminent domain movie. It's always on, so you can watch it on YouTube. But it occurred to me as I was watching it that if there were real zombies, we wouldn't blow their heads off, I hope. We would round them up and try and figure out what's wrong with them and treat them and make them better. So then I sat down and wrote a fake medical paper, just for the heck of it, just to occupy my mind, about what is the putative disease that makes zombies sick.
Tell us a little bit more, though, about your background. Like, for example, how did you get interested in psychiatry?
When I went to medical school, it's funny, if you look at statistics about folks who go into medicine, most people go to psychiatry despite the experience they have in medical school, not because of it. That's actually one of the things I do professionally. I'm in charge of medical student education at Harvard. And I try to make the psychiatric educational experience better. That's important to me because you really don't have a good exposure to what the wonders and amazing parts of being a psychiatrist are. I went to medical school. I was one of the few who actually went thinking I'd be a psychiatrist, and I think that's because I love stories. I was a high school English teacher beforehand. The questions that always came to me in writing about works of kind of highbrow fiction, why is Bartleby and Bartleby the Scrivener so quiet? Why will he only say I prefer not to? Those are the kinds of questions that just floated my boat. And so then I got to medical school. I liked everything I learned a lot, but really I liked psychiatry the most, so I ended up sticking with it.
And psychiatry, I mean, is it specifically because it's about the brain and the chemistry of the brain, but also about human psychology and it's at the interstices of the two?
Absolutely. The mind-brain-body dichotomies that we sort of artificially create in our culture, to me, that's the most fascinating aspects of what we study. It brings you pretty seamlessly into areas like how do you define self from other? What is the difference between mind and brain? How do we know what we feel and how do we feel what we know? I mean, those all sound like cliched questions, but those are the kinds of things that are really, really interesting. And also I like the ambiguity of psychiatry. It's not a slam dunk ever, really. And those kinds of diagnostic queries are fun for me.
So I'm wondering if this comes a little bit out of the educational background that you have. You majored in English and biology at Stanford. Why did you very early on couple the study of science to the study of the humanities?
When you look at studies of adult development, people often tell stories of how they made their decisions so that the story makes sense. But then when you do kind of prospective studies, ask folks, why did I major in English or biology? I would just say, yeah, it was fun. I could do my English homework while sitting under a tree and reading. And then the chemistry, I'd have to go deep into the library to study for my bio major. But I think looking back on it, those dichotomies we make between sciences and humanities are kind of false in my mind. The capacity to innovate scientifically, the capacity to draw deep conclusions from poetry, I think one discipline lends itself to the other. So they actually went together better for me and more naturally than other fields.
And is it explicitly, I think, your humanities background that led you to ask some of these more, let's say, metaphysical questions that you do in fact raise when you deal with zombies?
English literature or the study of humanities in general is characterized by some of the very large existential questions that rear their heads, you know, with their tongue deeply in their cheek in campy horror movies, including and maybe especially zombie movies. I also think a lot of this comes from going to Hebrew school 3 days a week. And some of the questions that were asked when I was a little Jewish kid growing up in Kansas City, those came back to me again when we were reading about zombies. So all that stuff kind of came together. That's why the protagonist of my book is clearly Jewish. I wanted that to be a point.
Steve, we're going to explore a little bit more about some of the big questions that come up in dealing with zombies when you unpack how they function as a trope. Also, what fascinates us about them and how we can learn something about neuroscience from dissecting zombies. But I want to give listeners a sense of the zombie autopsies as a novel. Can you describe the book? Give it to us in a nutshell, because its form as a novel is unusual.
Yeah, it's a strange work. It's meant to represent the kind of found footage books. There was a series of books, Edgar Allan Poe wrote things like this, where it was as if a journal had been dug up, and in reading the journal, the first-person account of what had happened, historians could look back on this purported history, this false history, and make sense of something awful or amazing or fascinating that had taken place. I sat down to write it as if it were a diary being kept by the last remaining scientist to have been sent by the CDC and the United Nations to a laboratory that was designated, especially through a UN charter, zombies, to study humans who had been infected with the zombie virus. But there's a twist to it in that everyone's infected on the whole planet. When you get there, the rapidly progressing virus progresses even more rapidly. Nobody lives. Nobody lives when they're on the island. They always progress to the fourth stage of the disease, where the scientists who get to the island are moved into the holding pen, and then the next group of scientists come in and have their next group of people to dissect. And calling it autopsies is a kind of play on words, because they're not really dead. They're very, very, very ill. That's some of the metaphysical issues. But they couldn't get themselves to cut them open unless they would call it autopsies. And the virus has to be examined by cutting people open when they're still alive, which is gory and gross, and I would never in a million years endorse in real life. But in a fictional account, it sort of opens up these questions. So as the book progresses, the very protagonists who are solving this horrific medical mystery are getting sicker and sicker and wonder whether they can trust their own conclusions precisely because their senses are being robbed of them by the virus.
So dial back just a little bit in the way that you do in the book. We've got this found notebook, but it's prefaced by this UN memo that's been written about this virus. Tell us a little bit about the doomsday scenario that frames the book as a whole.
Okay, so when the book takes place, the UN is no longer based in New York, because all major cities, as we've seen in what's been this explosion of apocalyptic tropes in dystopian novels, New York's gone, the UN is gone, a third of humanity's gone, dead. And the UN now exists on a small island in the South Pacific, and they have returned from an expedition to that island, a different island where the lab was, and are reporting back to their members about the details in this diary. In this circumstance, humans have tried to eradicate the virus through both nuclear and non-nuclear versions. Basically, everything they throw at the bug just sticks around and gets stronger. The humans just get sicker. The infrastructure has about 10 years to go before it falls apart entirely, our industrial infrastructure. So things are very, very, very dire. The ecological state of the planet is on edge because of the attempts to eradicate the virus. And this is really the last chance we have as a species to make ourselves survive.
And part of what gives it its kind of pulsating beat as it goes through is that Dr. Bloom, who's not really well equipped to be able to do this, is engaged in these autopsies of zombies that makes up a fair bit of his journal. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Sure, yes. Stanley Bloom is the protagonist. He's an MD, PhD, but never practiced medicine, so never did a residency, is a neuroscience expert, taught for a long time in the Boston area, and then ended up getting a position at the CDC where he's essentially an administrator, which there's nothing wrong with being an administrator, but it's not somebody who typically holds scalpels and does experiments. In part because he's friendly with Dr. Gutierrez, who's the Andalusian molecular biologist who's on the island. He's the one who's sent to work with her. She's too sick to perform these autopsies herself, so she has to instruct him how to do it. It's a little bit like the person who hasn't flown a plane in a million years and has to land the plane because the pilot is sick. He's got to do the same thing, but he himself is sick. So he's getting sicker in addition to all of the people on the island who are still have their wits about them getting sicker. So Bloom is an underdog from the start, but he's also a deeply ethical man, and he's troubled by a lot of things. I mean, at the very beginning, he's troubled just by the thought that we would call these autopsies, since what he's cutting into is looking at him, watching him as he does it.
And I want to get into that a little bit more, but I think really the way to do it is to talk a little bit more about the supplementary materials that come along with Bloom's journal. The book is kind of shaped by all of these supplementary materials that are in the appendix. So it's got a glossary of terms. We can hear already from the way that you're talking about it, your background as a doctor and as a scientist very much come into play here. There's a fake medical journal article about ataxic neurodegenerative satiety deficiency syndrome, ANSD. I guess that's the fake medical paper that you first started this whole project with. And that's the scientific, ANSD is the scientific name for zombieism. You've got this UN emergency resolution document, which is written just exactly like a UN document, which explains how the world body has responded to the zombie apocalypse. And you've got others. So can you tell us a little bit about some of them and why you included the appendices and how you see them relating to the journal itself that makes up much of the novel?
As we pointed out, my tongue's in my cheek as I write this, but I also wanted to create this sense of verisimilitude. I wanted it to feel as real as possible. So I was thinking, if this is going to look plausible, I have to do a few things. One is that UN charter that you noted, the UN resolution. If you go online, you can find UN resolutions, and you can play around with the language. And the language is discussing things of any UN resolution that are immensely important. World hunger, how do we stop war, how do we stop genocide? But the words themselves are so unbelievably bureaucratic that it just struck me as fascinating, this sort of dry language to go with these incredibly intense and powerful movements. So I changed the words around and basically took an existing UN treaty that had to do with protection of human rights and religious freedoms around the world and modified it to be the lack of protection for people who entered stage 4 of the disease, but then the ethical mandate that you can never, just for the heck of it, kill a zombie. That would be wrong. You have the right to dispatch them, to deanimate them, as they say, and you have the right to go ahead and have funeral services when people have hit stage 4 of the disease, but it's never okay to hurt them deliberately. So there's this kind of weird tightrope that we're always walking, and we walk that all the time in science. With the fake medical paper, I decided to call it ataxic neurodegenerative satiety deficiency syndrome, in part because when doctors and medicine and culture are afraid of new diseases, we abbreviate them because I think that makes them less scary. So then we end up calling it ANSD. And it turns out that ANSD actually has a life of its own. People have created a Wikia fan site for it. The CDC mentioned it in their blog about disaster preparedness. They mentioned it again with their tongue in their cheek. But then they had to come out later and say, look, ANSD doesn't exist. So it was this kind of strange world where I had to go around telling people that I just made this up. The whole point is to create a world at the end of the book that makes it seem as real and as plausible as possible, despite how outlandish zombies are. In fact, if you look at the references of the fake medical paper, some of those are real references from the medical journals, and some of them are just papers I made up. Attack behavior of stage 3 humanoids with ANSD, published in Nature Neuroscience in 2013, for example. I mean, those are the kinds of things that are interspersed with real references. And in fact, if you look through those references, you can solve the mystery of the book, because the folks in the book don't do so well at solving it entirely, although the mystery does get solved.
The most important one of those appendices is Gutierrez's letter to the pastor of her childhood parish. You already mentioned Dr. Blanca Gutierrez. Tell us a little bit more about her character, who she is in the story. And then from there, tell us about what this letter points to in terms of some of the big questions that are raised by zombie stories.
She's one of my favorite characters, and I can tell you that the book's being made into a movie now, and we've expanded her character and her relationship with Bloom. It's been really fun to do. So she's from Andalusia, from this beautiful region of southern Spain. The folks have been there, a place that I've traveled and absolutely adore and love for its mixture of the very, very old and the very new. You can see shepherds tending to their flock, and you can go and get this amazing cup of espresso in a little tiny town. I wanted her to be a kind of mixture of old and new. She's devoutly religious. She's Catholic. She's very close to the pastor who, you know, was in charge of the parish where she grew up, but also was recognized early on in the village where she grew up as being quite brilliant. So she went, studied molecular biology and virology, and is troubled when this virus breaks out, in part because it's just so frightening, but also because of the existential questions that it raises. And she doesn't know who to talk to other than her pastor. And we get a sense of that from the letter that she writes to the pastor she had growing up, where she says, look, they've given me this kind of devil's bargain. Like, I either call them dead, but they're clearly not dead. So what do we call human, Father? That's what she's asking. I mean, we can't do it by chromosomes because we know that people with more than the human number of chromosomes are still considered humans. We can't do it by disease. We can't do it by how people behave. So what business do we have saying that people with stage 4 are NLH or no longer human? That's the language of the UN. But at the same time, she knows that it's only by following the dictates of the UN that she'll be able to solve this plague, which is man-made, by the way. That's another hint in the book. The plague didn't just sort of show up. It was created by really not nice people who we find out about in the sequel. So she's writing to her pastor saying, help me to sort of reconcile what in the past had always been fairly straightforward ethical quandaries for me. Right now, I'm feeling really uncomfortable in the fence they put me on.
And these existential questions pop up throughout the novel. Questions like, how do we define life? What makes someone human? Can someone stop being human? How do we respond as a species to disasters? Why do we tend to respond in such a binary way with either heroes or bigotry and xenophobia? Also the question of how is modern life becoming more zombie-like sometimes. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Schlossman about his novel, The Zombie Autopsies, and what zombies teach us about being human. In the section of the book that's included in my edition, where you're just responding to questions about why you wrote the book, you say that one of the things zombies permit us to reflect on is how our conscience works. This is what you write. Conscience is some kind of epic battle for the mirror neurons, frontal lobes, memories, and our primitive and competing desires to create and to destroy. If we take the internal battle away from our enemies, we say zombies don't have a conscience, zombies don't really have much of a brain at all, then we find our conscience resting substantially easier as we smash in the zombie's head with a fireplace tool. Steve, can you unpack this a little? Are you saying that understanding zombie neurobiology tells us something about how we draw the line between what kind of entities merit our ethical consideration and what kind don't?
I'm bringing up that question. I'm not sure I have a good answer for that question. What I mean is I think those are questions worth pondering and continuing to ponder because they're not easily answered. What I'm trying to say there is that there's a bunch of things packed into that. One is there's this concept of mirror neurons, this notion that if you're drinking a cup of coffee and I watch you drink it, I literally taste that coffee. If you implant electrodes into the sensory region of my brain, I will taste that coffee. There are higher regions of my brain that sit on that, so I don't recognize that I taste that coffee. We would know it from the electrode readings, but higher regions, the frontal lobe in particular, would stop me from experiencing that consciously, because otherwise it would be psychosis. I would experience something that's not there. So we riff off of each other's emotions. That's actually a neurobiologic explanation for empathy. Now, what happens in zombie stories is the zombies don't give you anything back. When humans get in fire, we want to know how we're doing. If you're in a fight in a bar, which I've never been in, but I've seen a lot of movies with them, you throw that first punch and you look at the experience of the person that you've punched and base what you're going to do next on their response. But the zombies don't give anything back. They don't flinch. They don't look happy. They don't look sad. They just keep walking towards you unless you hit them in the head. So that sort of mirror neuron battle where higher and lower brain processes, which are trying to instruct us on what to do next, that goes away almost immediately because the zombies, you can convince yourself, have been dehumanized, even if it looks exactly like what your girlfriend used to look like. And that is classic for almost every zombie movie worth its salt. The ones that I really like are loaded with those moments where, you know, shooter man, no, she's already dead, I can't, it's my girlfriend. That sort of back and forth argument that happens until it's too late. To me, those are the most fascinating, most frightening aspects of the movie. So in that passage, what I was trying to say is we kind of relish these moments in these zombie movies about having the freedom to just shoot them at will. And a lot of good zombies, you think of Dawn of the Dead, they sit on the roof of the shopping mall and just pick off the zombies and are having a good time at first. But after a while, that experience starts to eat away at them. They can't stand the fact, the humans can't stand the fact, that they're not getting anything back from the zombies. All they're getting is a bunch of dead zombies, and the zombies are already technically dead. So then the humans turn on each other. And all of those things you just mentioned, the bigotry, the racism, the sort of silly reasons that humans don't get along, those all get amplified precisely because the enemy doesn't give them anything back.
So a big part of what you're saying is that part of our fascination with the undead is really because it enables us to have the safe place to explore these really quite profound questions. But in your answer, you've suggested part of what it is that you do specifically with the zombie trope. So when you came to Rhodes, your lecture was titled How to Inadvertently Learn Some Neuroscience While Preparing for the Zombie Apocalypse. And part of what you're doing is teaching about human neurobiology by explaining how a zombie brain works. In a sense, your lecture is a tour of the human brain using the living dead as a narrative theme. So how does dissecting zombie brains teach us something about the neuroscience behind the human brain?
If you watch a zombie movie, and here we're talking specifically, and we should clarify, about the slow, shambling zombies, the ones we first saw invented in 1968 in Night of the Living Dead, in George Romero's first movie, and then since then in a number of really fantastic movies. And if you think about how the brain works, so if you're somebody who understands a little bit about functional neurobiology, you can't not think about what's wrong with their brain. Once you say, okay, they're sick, and it looks like, given the way they're acting, that the part of their body that's sick happens to be their brain, then you start sort of breaking down the brain into its various functional elements and decide how and in what way those regions are dysfunctional. So that allows you then to kind of sneak some neuroscience in the back door in a place that folks might not be expecting to learn it, which makes it actually, I think, that much more fun.
And that's exactly what you do in the course of the book. You talk a little bit about these different parts of the brain. Give us a little bit of a sense of this. So the first thing that ends up being dissected by Dr. Bloom is the frontal lobe. You go from there to talk a little bit about some other parts of the brain. Give us a little bit of a sense of what different parts of the brain do in terms of shaping our reactions and responses to various situations.
What's been really fun about this is people who've read this book, kids, you know, like 10, 11, 12, even though it's kind of a gory book, have written me and asked me neuroscience questions and sent me articles from medical journals. So that part of it has been just so gratifying to know that I haven't just written this kind of creepy, outlandish book, but kids have really been into it and have learned a lot of neuroscience. So if we start with the frontal lobe is the most sophisticated part of the brain. It's the one that's evolved most recently. So if you look at brain function in and of itself, it develops layers throughout evolution. So this is the very top layer. It's the region of the brain responsible for our ability to make complex decisions, to solve complex problems, to plan things, to know whether or not we have enough time to get the work done that we need to get done. It also controls impulsivity. So the desire to not do something gets controlled by your frontal lobe. So if somebody cuts you off in the freeway, you might have a desire to hang your middle finger out the window. Your frontal lobe then sits on that, hopefully, if you're lucky, and says, you know, there's a lot of good reasons not to cut that person off. They might be your boss. They might have a gun. There's all sorts of reasons not to get into a bit of road rage. That's the role of the frontal lobe. It's sometimes called the executive region of the brain because you think of all of the jobs of a busy executive. It's also the region of the brain that allows us to play with abstractions. It's one of the areas that actually you see go away in people who have frontal lobe damage.
Zombie brains, I mean, their frontal lobe is total mush, right? It just leaks all over the operating table.
It's mush. I mean, that's why they can't open windows, can't open doors, can't think.
And the next thing, it's the hypothalamus that becomes sort of a central concern. Why does Guterres seem to think that this might be the root of the whole zombie virus?
This is the quandary that they're in terms of diagnostic inquiries. If you're as sick as you are with this virus, and people run fevers of 105 in this book, their pulse is way up, they look horrific, they're dying. When you're that sick, you're never hungry. I mean, we're not hungry when we have a cold. So the fact that these creatures, these humans, are ravenously hungry has to be explained in some way. That's actually the trickiest part of the zombie neurobiology. If you're thinking above the neck, if you're below the neck, you could talk about things like tapeworms, things that take the food away. But I'm thinking about the brain. So there's a region of the brain, the ventromedial hypothalamus, that's directly responsible for letting you know that you've eaten enough. It's a satiety region of the brain. It tells you you're sated. We have the capacity to ignore it. We do so all the time on holidays, Thanksgiving, and things like that. But there are viruses that can infect the ventromedial hypothalamus and make that region of the brain unable to receive signals from the gut to tell you that you're full. So you just keep eating, and you eat towards obesity. It creates pathological ravenous hunger. And it turns out, as they're dissecting the brain, that region of the brain is weirdly, oddly preserved. So it occurs to Gutierrez that it must be infected by something that fights off the rest of the zombie virus, but also protects it and makes it more powerful than the rest of the otherwise rotting brain.
So her thesis is there must be more than one virus, otherwise the zombies wouldn't have such a ravenous desire to consume human meat.
Exactly, or a recombinantly designed virus, but there's more than one pathogen, exactly.
Steve, one of the things I thought about reading the book was that it would be almost impossible to have a zombie story without visual representations of zombies. And you have a really clever device for how you get pictures of zombies into the novel. Tell us about the character of the medical illustrator, Dr. James Pittman, and also about whether you agree that having pictures of zombies is really key to zombie stories.
I think that pictures are key. I think the challenge in any zombie story, in any zombie movie, is to show some gore in a way that forces you to challenge what you think and believe about what's human. And I know that sounds really gross and horrific, but anybody who likes this genre, and I can tell you everybody I know who's written about zombies, who from George Romero to Max Brooks to myself, we're all as pacifist as it gets. We really, really hate violence. So what we're working on there in showing these really gory pictures, these sort of rotting bodies, is at what point are we willing to decide that they've rotted so much that we can no longer think of them as human and therefore have the permission to do with them things differently than we would than if they were human. In the book, I wanted drawings rather than photos. I mean, photos are obviously harder to get because zombies aren't real, but I also wanted kind of almost gothic drawings, black and white drawings, and I started thinking of Grey's Anatomy, not the TV show, of the textbook that we used in medical school that had these amazing drawings of the human body, which is an incredibly complex thing. I wanted those drawings to be done by a medical illustrator, which is an actual career. Folks sign up to be medical illustrators, and they're amazing artists, and I wanted those drawings to be accompanied with Bloom's dissections. The reason there have to be drawings instead of photos is the digital infrastructure's fallen apart, so they can't count on beaming photos back through satellite images because none of the satellites are working anymore. So all of the drawings occur in the book, but Pittman is drawing people he knew. Remember, these are scientists who came and then turned into zombies, so now he's drawing people he knew as they get cut open.
And Steve, your book is a fictional representation of how an international group of scientists, policymakers, epidemiologists, and ethicists, as well as doctors on the front lines, respond to a massive outbreak of zombieism. So my last question to you is, are we ready as a planet for the inevitable zombie outbreak? Or, in your expert yes. opinion, do we yes. need to be talking about zombies far more than we have been?
So I can tell you, at Comic-Con and other horror conventions that I've gone to for the last few years, which have been really fun, people always say, when will the zombie apocalypse happen? It's not even an if, it's a when. And then all of us on the panel say, you know, it's not going to happen. We're humans. We have plenty of ways of doing ourselves in without the zombies. And then people boo. And we're always saying, look, if you don't watch these movies, they are metaphors. This would be a really awful thing to happen. So to the extent that they're metaphors, they are representations of when the infrastructure falls apart. George Orwell talks about zombies as the thing that happens. So zombies make for an interesting storyline. But are we ready? Here's the bigger question. Are we ready for a mass pandemic? We're a little bit overdue for a mass pandemic if you read what the epidemiologists tell us and the infectious disease experts. But we also have much, much better infrastructure than we did during the last mass pandemic, which was the Spanish flu, the influenza flu in early 1900s. So do we need to be talking about zombies? Not to the extent that zombies are real. They're not real. And I actually have to remind people of that. I literally have to go online and write, they are not real. But I do think it behooves us to be ready to take care of ourselves as a society, not as individuals, not to sort of set our perimeters and make enemies and friends, but figuring out ways to stick together so that when bad things happen, when natural or unnatural disasters take place, we are prepared psychologically and infrastructurally.
And I guess part of my own tongue-in-cheek question is also a way of asking you about whether or not you think that we need more vehicles such as your book to talk about these really big questions that are clearly what you see as behind the whole zombie trope, the whole issue of how do we define life? What does make someone human? Can someone stop being human, etc.? So do you think that we actually need more of these kinds of fun vehicles into the really serious approach that you take, which is that we need to understand the neurobiology, we need to understand these ethical quandaries that underpin zombies?
I do. I think that these kinds of questions are very, very difficult to discuss if you discuss them with a sort of one-to-one relationship. But if you discuss them in displacement, and I don't know if we need more. We need to be more willing to discuss the things that are already out there. If you think of the fantastic television that's on right now, and I'm not talking necessarily about The Walking Dead. I mean, that's a great show, but watching Breaking Bad, watching Justified even, I mean, these shows which bring up these really, really, really big questions. There's some great writing out there, not to mention this explosion of really good YA fiction. I think those are there because kids themselves are starting to ask these questions, the very ones that you just asked. And if we can combine the science and the humanities through these vehicles, and then if folks continue to write more and more of them, I actually think we'll be better off going forward.
So is this part of what you're integrating into the curriculum at Harvard Medical School for the students that you're teaching in psychiatry?
It's a great question. So I don't integrate it to the medical student. If they ask me about it, I'll talk about it. But I say, look, we have a limited amount of time to discuss these very significant diseases that we treat that are a huge burden on society. So we're going to discuss them. If you all want me to talk to you at a different time at, say, the student interest group in the evening, and they've asked me to do that a bunch of times, I'm more than happy to do it. And if you want to talk to me about writing about these things, I'm more than happy to do it. So I try to keep a firewall up in part because I respect so much what I do and the patients that I take care of. And I don't want anybody ever to think that I would be calling a psychiatrically ill patient or any patient for that matter a zombie. But in terms of teaching, if people give me the opportunity, so if somebody as Rhodes and you were kind enough to do invite me, say, hey, can you come down here and give us a lecture about neuroscience using the vehicle of zombies, I'll be there yesterday. That's the part that I really like doing.
But Steve, it seems to me your diagnosis for what needs to be happening more is to have a breakdown of these kinds of firewalls, I think, between the humanities and the sciences. And I think that's part of what we appreciate so much. Thanks so much for being with us today on Counterpoint to explain why we're so fascinated by zombies and also what they help us to understand about being human beings.
I agree with you. I think that firewall should go down, and it was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening. ¶¶